This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. This week we have no sponsor, but if you'd like to sponsor the show, you can get in touch with us through our website at outofschool.net. Evening, Bradley, how are you?
I am absolutely fantastic. It's been an exciting day because I have now solved my Google Reader problem.
Okay,
detail. A friend of mine from Twitter, underscore David Smith, who also makes the incredibly useful Check the Weather application for the iPhone and iPad, just released his service called Feed Wrangler. That's a subscription-based service that includes free access to an iPhone and iPad app. And he says a Mac OS X app is coming soon. It's only $18 a year for that. So I'm really excited about that. Of course, you know, we were joking offline that, you know, your currency is so much better than ours. That's basically a dollar for you.
Absolutely. Everything's practically free for British people, apart from everything that's sold in Britain, of course.
True.
Sales tax conversation. Moving on. So this is your replacement for Google Reader, right?
Yeah, and it's really good so far. I get $18 a year to me is one of those, you know, anything under 50, not that it's not, you know, not that I just have money, you know, growing out my nose, but
you're sitting on,
you know, since I got on RSS probably 5 or 6 years ago back in the blog lines days, you know, that shows you how long I've been around RSS. It's really allowed me to just stay up on what's happening, you know, in technology, in the news, and sports, without actually having to do much. And so for me, $18 in time saved is a, you know, good decision. And it's got an open API. So, you know, the hope is that some of the other popular applications will integrate with it as well. So it's a feature.
That's really interesting. Because since we knew Google Reader was going away, I started to try and migrate. I've used Flipboard as my Google Reader client for, well, ever since Flipboard's iPhone app shipped, which must be like 18 months to 2 years ago. So what I tried to do was to kind of extract all those little feeds from Google Reader and make them channels in Flipboard. And what I found was that that was actually super annoying because a channel in Flipboard takes up a lot of space. You know, it's a big tile on your kind of home screen in Flipboard, which is great for channels like The Verge and Macworld and things that update frequently because there's a lot of new content comes through them. But it's a lot of space to take up for one channel that maybe updates once a month. You know, there's some British bloggers that I like to follow who are really whatever the opposite of prolific is, I don't know. But everything they read, I want to read. Everything they post, I want to read. I don't want to miss anything. But taking up space on my Flipboard home screen is really annoying. So hopefully with that API, we might be able to wrangle something where I can connect that to Flipboard. And that would be pretty cool.
Well, your blog is a perfect example of one that, for me, is just really why RSS was built. Because I don't want to miss anything that you post, but you don't post every day. You may post once a week, maybe once a month, but it's usually a pretty informed post, and I don't want to miss it. And so it keeps me from, I guess, going to your website, you know, every hour to see if there's been something new. You know, I read a lot of independent authors, like Sean Blanc, Stephen Hackett, that we've talked about in the past, Daring Fireball, of course. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, yeah, that's the focus of my, I guess, my online reading, and RSS is perfect for that. Because if I go off the grid for a day, I come back, I can just, you know, open it up, skim through it, mark as read, and move on.
Yeah, because the way I used Google Reader and Flipboard was basically Google Reader was like one channel out of many, and it was all the kind of slow-burning feeds that went in there, and then the noisy feeds were off in other channels out of my RSS. But since that's kind of broken down now, I'm definitely going to try out that thing that you mentioned.
Yeah, they've got a free 14-day trial, and you can either pay for it online through Stripe, or you can download the app and do an in-app purchase. Don't believe there's there's a 14-day refund policy, but I don't think that applies to the in-app purchase as well.
Okay, cool. Well, my day has been entirely devoted to Apple Configurator. Because as we've mentioned before, you know, a refresh is coming along and we're making some changes to the way we deploy apps and so on. And obviously this is the first summer we've got to where we've had the volume purchase program available in the UK. So I've mentioned before it came out in the UK 1 week after we started school for this year. So I'd already deployed everything and set it up with the old system and then VPP came out. So we've been kind of running in borrowed time a little bit with the old system. So we're moving over to VPP, and have we actually done a show about configurator and volume purchase in detail?
I don't think so. Like, not in terms of, like, here's how you do this, or, you know, kind of in-depth on the ownership models. So that might be a good topic for the future, especially because most people kind of do this in the summer.
Yeah, that may be a good summer show, because I mean, obviously I've been looking at Configurator since it came out, but I've never used it in anger until really the past couple of weeks and trying to get this all up and running. And there's quite a few moving parts to it, and it's not really obvious exactly how you should use the app, because what you really have to understand about it is basically, what do you want to do? How does that look on the device? And then how do you sort of interpret that through the interface of Configurator? So we should probably catch up with that at some point. But basically, I kind of cracked it today, and I think I figured it out. So I think one of the things that's kind of new is the terminology, like layered model and personal model and institutional model, that we sort of hacked up years ago and figured out it could be done, but Apple's kind of formalized those now so that you can do them yourself. So once I get that refined a little bit, we should put together a show on that as well.
That might, if I don't know how we would distribute it, but that might be a good show to do, like a Google Hangout or a screencast or something like that for people to catch up on.
Yeah, we should definitely try that at some point. I mentioned that I had sort of understood it finally on Twitter today, and a few people said they'd like to kind of see how that looks in operation. So yeah, maybe we'll try that at some point.
Yeah, you got to use the fully baked version of Apple Configurator. You didn't get to beta test it with the rest of us here in the States, because this will be my second summer going through it. And the decision I am trying to decide is, do I wipe everything, or do I leave our, because we're really more than almost doubling our iPad, the amount of iPads we had. So I've got to decide, like, do I wipe what we have, grab those codes back? And so I don't know. It just will depend. I have not made up my decision yet. I'm actually sitting here looking at my Configurator machine. Oddly enough, it's a 2009 MacBook. It doesn't have to be a beast of a machine. It just has to be a machine.
Yeah, I was putting together mine on a Mac Mini for comparison.
I would definitely make Time Machine backups of that, because I had an issue once where, like, an app update hosed the app, and I actually had to restore the whole machine from a Time Machine backup to be able to fix it.
Yeah, it definitely becomes a pretty precious machine. You think about the amount of money you're kind of locking up in that machine with all those codes that you're going to put in it. So there's definitely more to say on that. But it's interesting you should bring up the whole idea of data storage and so on, because that was really the topic that we sort of put together for today, was some things that we'd been thinking about, and you and I discussed offline separately about where do we go with data storage. You know, we're starting to get, you know, our iPad deployment is like the oldest one in the world, I guess. But other people are kind of coming up to the same kind of breaking point. And we actually had problems with this last year as well. Like, we've done so much on these devices. Where do we put all this stuff? And up till now, we've done some pretty crude things. Like, last summer, I just wiped everything. And I said, you know, the month before school ended, I was kind of like, well, email yourself anything you really, really, really want to keep, and I'm just going to blow away your iPad in the summer. Now, obviously, for some kids, we didn't do that because they were going through a 2-year course, but for everybody else, we're just like, sorry, there's all your stuff gone, kind of thing. And that was a bit of a panic stations thing. So I thought what we might talk about today, Bradley, is just what we're doing right now, what are the options right now, and where do we kind of see this going in the future?
Sounds great.
All right. So you're using Dropbox, right, on your Macs?
Yes, we are using Dropbox on the Macs as a kind of a poor man's file server.
So you're kind of already taking all that data and keeping it offboard in the cloud?
Yes. But if we I know in our fifth grade, we actually do use Google Drive quite heavily. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that we use Google for is authentication into various services that they use. I know one of them that they're heavily into right now is the online presentation tool Prezi. And so that's one of the other things that really Google has solved for us, is just kind of like the single login for these various services.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Google Apps. We've been on it since 2006, I want to say, maybe even 2005. And it's great, really great for us. But basically, the point that we got to over this this past year was that the big new thing for us this year was to use iTunes U. So iTunes U, as we've talked about in previous shows, it basically handles the outbound half of what you might call a learning management system. It lets you create posts and put up materials and stuff, and it's all kind of from the teacher to the student. It's all one direction. And the thing that I feel that we haven't broken through with yet is getting teachers a proper kind of paperless workflow that goes around from the student to the teacher and back to the student and so on. And we tried this a couple of years ago with Pages documents, and we tried it through email. And I was suggesting things like, well, if you get them to send you a Pages document, then you could highlight the text and turn it red and, you know, put your comment in smaller text below it or something. And it was kind of horrible, you know. So what we've been looking for in secondary is a workflow that goes from teacher to student. Work gets done there, it gets handed in, it can be marked, it can be sent back, and then it can be archived. And this is kind of independent of anything somebody might do in the class. Do you know what I mean? So I don't want to constrain teachers into saying you've got to use this app, and this app, and that's all you can use because those are the ones that kind of integrate with our system. Right? So I don't want to put restrictions on the apps that can be used in the classroom. But what I want to do is for all the kids, I want them to have there's at least kind of a baseline or a backbone workflow, if you like, that whatever you do in class, this is how you get the information, this is how you submit it, and this is how you store it for the long term. Does that make sense? Sort of three-part workflow.
Well, you think about, let's take the tech out of it. Let's say you go back to when you and I were in school. You when you were done with your work, you put it in the completed box, the teacher mm-hmm. graded it, handed it back to you, and you put it into a folder. We're basically trying to recreate that digitally.
Pretty much, yeah. And at least in the first instance, I don't even necessarily want to... I mean, we've talked in the past about using video for assessment and things like that, but if I could even just make a usable, fast, digital version of that piece of paper in a tray and save the teachers carrying that stuff home at night, that would be a step forward, I think.
But even... I mean, let's say... You know, we're in education. We love customized solutions, like how we use at our school. We use a specific CRM that's built for schools. You know, we don't use Salesforce. Mm-hmm. We use RenWeb. And so, you know, it's kind of like if you were building this app, you would have, you know, you would build what you want, and a student could hit I'm completed with this project, and it would show up in a teacher's iPad. You know, so and so has completed it, and you could grade it and say, you know, graded, and the students gets notified. Like, we're not looking for complicated solutions here.
No, very, very simple solutions. So over the course of this kind of last week, I spent some time trying to write down in words how I think we should work as a workflow between teachers and students in our school. And I don't want to get rid of iTunes U. I think the iTunes U innovation has been really good. But I think the feedback we've got from some students is that all of these different moving parts can be a bit overwhelming, particularly for kids who are just stepping up into secondary. So they've been asking us for, give us some simple kind of touch points throughout the week where we know we do this here, we do that there, we do that there, and the other stuff might be in apps or whatever. So we're going to keep iTunes U, but we have found a couple of apps that kind of plug in the second and third phase of that we think are going to work for us. And I'm not going to lie, I'm late to the party on this one, but the app we're talking about is Shobie, Shobie, which is a really interesting app and service that basically does that kind of completed work tray aspect of the job. I think the reason I didn't pick up on Shobie because people said, oh, you should check out this Shobie app. And I was like, well, Shobie, what does an app called Shobie do? And then I thought, well, it was some kind of presentation thing, or it's kind of like an explain everything knockoff or whatever. And, you know, I think Shobie's biggest problem is that the name doesn't really suggest what it actually does. So maybe, I don't know if I had to rename it or not, but certainly It confused me for a while. Are you familiar with Shobi, Bradley?
I have briefly, I guess, looked at the website, but not sit down with it in detail. So, and it's in fact, I'm glad I didn't, because I kind of get to hear this as our listeners will.
Okay. Well, let me kind of lay the idea for you, right? It is a isolated document exchange system between students and teachers. So, and I say isolated because if you think about iTunes U, the teacher would not send marked work back to a student through iTunes U, because obviously it would then go to everybody subscribed to the course, and you want that channel to be private between the teacher and the student. Okay? So Shobi basically fills in that missing part from iTunes U. As a teacher, what I would do is I at the start of the year, I go in and I set up all my classes. So I'm teaching higher computing and National 5 computing and S1 computing or whatever. And I'll set up those classes, and Shobi will, for me, generate a class code, a kind of subscription code, six or seven random digits that I then give to the class. So maybe on the first day of class, I'll say, right, kids, open up Shobi, join this class, and I'll just write the code on the board, let's say. So that's how the students get access to my class. And what it's used for is when I have an assignment that I want to set to the kids, the way I would work together with iTunes U and Shobi is I would post the assignment in iTunes U, I would post the materials that the kids need along with that assignment and all the instructions there. But at the same time as posting that, I would create the assignment in Shobi as well. Okay? So imagine, let's say for the sake of this discussion, that that assignment is write an essay in Pages, right? Something really very substitution level thing, where instead of doing it on paper, I'm going to do it digitally. So I'll type my essay in Pages. As a student, I'll type my essay in Pages. And then what I do is when I'm done with that, instead of what we do at the moment is emailing a PDF to the teacher, or in many cases, actually just printing it out and handing a piece of paper to the teacher, to my shame, what I'll do is I will use the open in feature of Pages, and I will open that file in Shobi. Okay, so if you think about how Dropbox works, if you want to upload a file into your Dropbox from iOS, you have to open the file in the Dropbox app, and then it says, oh, where do you want to upload that? Well, Shobi takes the exact same principle. I open the file in Shobi, and it says, here are the assignments that are open to you right now that have pending deadlines. Where do you want to put it? And because I'm logged in with my name, I say, well, I want to put it in higher computing assignment number one, go. And Shobi will upload my file to the Shobi web service. With me so far?
I am.
That's the submission side of it. Now, what that looks like to a teacher is I log into Shobi on my teacher iPad, and I go into my class, higher computing. I go into the assignment one, and then what I see there is I see a list of all the students who've submitted something for that assignment. So I've got, Andrew and Bob and Alice and Jim and whoever all separated out, and I can tap on any student. And then in the right-hand pane of the screen, I see whatever it is they've uploaded. So it might be a PDF file or a Pages document or something like that. And that's basically what Shobi does. That's the kind of bit of magic that Shobi does, is it takes what would be an otherwise undifferentiated folder of uploads, and it separates them out by who uploaded them. Okay, so if you imagine trying to make that work in a Dropbox or a Google Drive, you'd have to set up the assignment, you'd have to set up all the folders for every assignment, and then trust the students to put their stuff in the right folder, basically, whereas Shobi will categorize that for you. That's basically the start of the process for a teacher. Now, if I want to mark an assignment, say this essay that's been handed in as a PDF in Shobi, I can take that PDF, I can preview it in Shobi, but I can also then open it in, say, PDF Expert on my iPad. PDF Expert can be the tool that I use to annotate this PDF. And when I'm done in PDF Expert, I can open it back in Shobi. Shobi does a little clever thing at this point. It says, okay, the last time we went away from Shobi, we were in this folder belonging to this student in this assignment in this class. Let's, by default, re-upload this new file to that same place. So it helps you by kind of taking you back to exactly where you were and uploading the corrected file into the same folder. So you start to be able to have a back and forth with each student for each assignment separated out by student. And this starts to become really quick. This is almost as fast as doing it on paper, really, because you just go, you know, pupil A, open it in, mark, 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 send it back to pupil A, we're done. Pupil B, open it, mark, 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 we're done. And you're not even lifting and laying papers as such, you're just doing it on your iPad, which is really cool. And Shobi also does a couple of other things. It lets you put little text messages in the stream of uploads. So there are files in there, but you can also put text comments in there. You can put voice comments in there, and you can upload photos into that stream as well. So that's the basics of Shobi. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it actually makes perfect sense. Yeah. You know, and actually, while you're talking, I pulled up the website as well, so I kind of get a visual, and it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I looked at Shobi a while ago, and I kind of held back from it because I felt their iOS app didn't have the right level of polish that I was looking for to put in front of my teachers. But in recent releases, I think it's really hit the heights. And one of the things I really like about it is that I never have to touch the website. I can do everything I need to do from the teacher's iOS app. So it's the same app for both teachers and students, but you log in as a teacher or you log in as a student and you see a slightly different interface depending on which one you are. So you can make classes, you can add assignments, you can evaluate assignments, mark them, all from the teacher's iPad. You never have to hit the website, which is really, really cool. It's a really kind of iOS native workflow that works pretty well.
But that's, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's a native iOS workflow, and that's really what you're trying to keep away from, like, well, this kind of works on the iPad, but it's really actually a lot easier on the computer.
Yeah, because the one thing I know now is that nobody wants to hear a story that says, go back to your Mac and do blah, blah, blah. And I think that's something that is kind of like a fundamental for me when choosing services or systems that I want to use in the school, is it's got to be a really native iOS experience.
I agree that you know, it's one of those things when we went to laptops, you try to not have to go to your desktop. When you kind of pick a new device, you want it to work everywhere. And as, you know, we've talked about this in the past, that's one of the reasons that you and I love Evernote so much, is because, you know, functionally, the iPad app is just as good as the Mac app in most cases. And you know, that's why I prefer personally Evernote over Dropbox.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I mean, Dropbox has its advantages, but in terms of being a full peer of the desktop experience, things like Evernote are a lot richer in that respect. I think Shobi's going to come in. I've started to document this workflow. I'm going to present it to all the teachers. I've shown it to some teachers sort of informally. I'm going to present it to everybody next week. And I think people, particularly in secondary school, maybe not so much in primary, although, you know, it could be used in primary school as well, but certainly in secondary school, I think it's kind of the piece we've been looking for, because people have kept coming to me and saying, I'm almost kind of embarrassed, saying, well, I'm still using a lot of paper in my class, you know, is that okay, sort of thing? And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, it's fine, but do you want to go digital? I'm like, yeah, I'd love it if I could just do this thing on my iPad wherever I am, and that would be it. So I think Shobi could be very interesting. There's a couple of things I don't like about it. The only major stumbling block, I think, is you can't rename a file that's been uploaded in Shobi. And the reason this is a problem is because of the way that iWork apps work on iOS, which is you make a new file, and then it only asks you to name the file when you save it. So you end up with all of our kids have got like blank 87 documents in their pages. So either you've got to trust the kids to name the file before they upload it, or you've got to, you know, comment to them in Shobi and say, look, name your file properly and upload it to me or whatever. That's my one complaint. The other thing I'm not so sure about is Shobi's completely free, and I kind of wish I knew how it was free. This goes back to our conversation of several shows, I think, Bradley. That kind of lack of confidence about how can this be free for everybody forever. I don't know.
But what you're not wanting to do is implement this, get really integrated into your workflows, and then, you know, 2/3 through the way of a school year, their website just shuts down and it no longer works.
Yeah, that's certainly my concern. I mean, I don't have any evidence that says that Shobee are on the rocks or anything like that. But what their statement says on the website is basically, this level of service is free for everybody. In the future, we might have additional paid features and additional capacity and stuff. But for now, this is all free. And okay, that's fine. But see, with something like this, when you're talking about like the fundamental workflow that your school is built on, it does give me a little pause, because one of the when you're trying to effect change in the school, I or whoever brings in the idea invests a lot of personal capital in making these changes happen. And if I go out on a limb here and say, look, Shobee's great, or any app is great and it's going to work for us and we should all adopt this, and then suddenly it blows up in our face, that's pretty awkward for me or for anybody who comes along with that idea. So that's the middle part of the workflow. We're talking about distribution, assignment submission, and then the long-term archiving question. This is really at the heart of the problem, because I don't know what kind of iPads you're buying this summer, Bradley, but we're looking at buying full-size iPad 4, our fourth-generation iPad, with a 1080p camera on the back. And this 1080p camera on the back is freaking me out. I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like video and the camera is just a steam train coming down the track right towards me, and I'm not totally sure what I'm doing about it yet.
But again, it's not even going back to the laptop days where if you did pick the wrong one, you could just say, okay, we're going to suck it up and buy a lot of 500 gig drives or a lot of 320 gig drives. Like, once you pick it, you know, going back to that whole, the worst deployment is the one that doesn't work, or the most expensive deployment is the one that doesn't work. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're sitting there in December and you've got iPads that are, you know, 500 megabytes free.
Yeah. I've been using a Meraki installation to track who had the most full iPad in the school. And I was quite proud that it was my own daughter who was top of the entire school. In terms of iPad usage, she managed to hit 93% used. Everybody else was a maximum 65%, and she was a big spike up at the end. So score one for the Spears family, I guess. But to kind of try and address this problem, I mentioned at the start of the show that what we had done in previous years was have kids email work to their Google Apps email and then open it back on their iPad next year, because the email will live from year to year. And that was a very unsatisfactory experience. One, it was pretty slow to do, because you've got to, share this, email this file, address every single one of them separately, you know, and then manage the email and then manage it back. So I was looking at, I was casting around for something, and I started looking at, I know Dropbox could work for this. So I started looking at Dropbox for Teams, or what does Dropbox provide for free? I started looking at Box as well. And then I realized, well, we're kind of already sitting on the solution, which is Google Drive, right? Because we have Google Apps for our domain available to us. Google Drive is a feature of that that's there for free. And it has the iOS app now, so the workflow is easy. And everybody's already got an account on it, because it's just part of our login system. So they can all just log in with their school email and password into the Google Drive app and just start piling stuff into Google Drive. So it was interesting. People, when I mentioned it on Twitter, people asked me, well, what's wrong with Dropbox? And basically it was, A, Dropbox for business is really expensive. Dropbox for individuals is more than we need. Not everybody needs 100 gigabytes, you know, paid Dropbox account. And the free Dropbox account is only 2 gigabytes, whereas the free Google Drive that's in our apps domain is 5 gigabytes. So everybody's sitting on 5 gig for free, and that's the job done right there. So you mentioned some of your classes are using Google Drive, Bradley?
They are, and it's kind of in our fifth grade, that's where all of their documents they create throughout the year live. And it works well. Again, most of the students are already familiar with Gmail, I guess, personally. and the documents just work. The sharing is very, very easy. We really use Google Drive a lot. We mainly use the web version. You know, some people have the apps also installed on their phone, installed on their iPad, and use the local syncing folder. But it's mainly online. We use the Google Forms a lot for various things. Even use those with parents.
Yeah.
So it's really, you know, Google gets a lot, I guess, of, I don't know the word. They seem to be on the bad side of a lot of people for a lot of things they do. And obviously, Google's not a perfect company, but Google Drive, for the most part, is, in my opinion, unmatched in what it can offer.
Yeah, I've not been terribly impressed with the what used to be called Google Docs, right? The word processor and the presentation app and so on. And certainly in previous years, we had tried to use it on the iPad through Safari on the iPad, and that was just an appalling experience in every possible respect. But the way we're using Google Drive is we're kind of pretending those things don't exist because, I mean, like you're talking about using it from a Mac, and using it from a Mac is fine. You know, it works great, but not so great on iOS. Now, the Drive app has got editing of word processing documents and spreadsheets built in, but it's still not the same as Numbers and Pages, I wouldn't say. But we're using it basically as a storage repository for files that we generate in other apps. So we're not really using the spreadsheet and the word processor as much as we're just using it as a file storage location from stuff that we generate on the iPad. And the idea for us is not that it would be our round trip storage location, because when you're one-to-one iPad, you don't need to solve the problem of how do I get all this work off the iPad at the end of the day so that somebody else can use it tomorrow, right? The iPad remains primary storage for our pupils. But then, you know, say they shoot a 20-minute video in iMovie. They've got a bunch of footage there. Well, let's export that as a medium-sized video, upload it to Google Drive, and then we can clear off, you know, 15 gigabytes of footage or whatever that we shot with the camera. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about Google Drive for our use, rather than using the Docs integration on it as such. But I think that can work. I had a couple of classes. I did it with our primary six class today. I just went in and I said, guys, let's get Google Drive installed. We got them installed. We just logged straight in. And I said, you know how to use OpenIn. They learned that from Book Creator, where they make a book and they open it in iBooks to read it. Said it was just that, it's that workflow, but just to Google Drive. And everybody got it. Everybody started uploading the stuff that they cared about. And that'll just live on until next year. So I think that's going to work for us pretty well.
Good. Yeah, it's nice to have that tool available, especially at no additional cost.
Well, this is the thing. And of course, you can always buy more storage. I don't think we can at the moment. I think I have to do something with our Google Apps account because it's so old. It's not even a Google Apps for Education account. It's just a kind of Google Apps account when it used to be called Google Apps for Your Domain. So I think we have to get somehow converted to an education account before we can buy additional storage. And I don't anticipate buying additional storage for almost anybody who actually is in the school at the moment. It's more for people who will, you know, start school next year, and then they'll have 13 years of education making stuff every year that they want to keep in perpetuity. But I think the trick there is going to be just to buy it for the people who need it and not buy it for everybody in one go. And that was kind of the thing that put me off Dropbox for Teams, was that to even get started, they sort of assumed that you wanted like a terabyte for everybody, you know. I was like, well, I don't want to pay. And I did the numbers for buying that for a school, and it was going to be like $15,000 a year or something. I was like, well, we don't need that much storage. So I think we'll try and just buy, for people who end up making good stuff that they want to keep, we'll just fund that on a person-by-person basis as people fill up their space, rather than trying to buy it out for everybody. That's the workflow. I think iTunes U, Shobi, Google Drive. But not Google Drive, not as a kind of constantly round-tripping to Google Drive, as much as just, I'm done with that, let's archive it for Parents Night in the future in Google Drive. And the beauty of that as well is people could log into it from home and have a look at it there too.
Well, and that also helps you, you know, they've got, you know, kind of those, the Google Takeout where you can export everything, you download it, and that you know, somebody's graduating, wants to get some stuff, it's very easy to do that.
Cool. So I mentioned earlier on that we had a meeting next week with all of the teachers, and I thought what I might do is try and get a few shows out of what we're going to talk about in that meeting, but just to kind of trail a little bit for future shows, what we might be talking about is we've tried to identify the core set of applications from all of our experience with using all these different apps and apps. What we're trying to do is kind of simplify down now to a core set of apps that we think really give us a lot of power and don't make the system too confusing. Right? So we'll talk more about these in later shows, but just to give you an idea of what that list looks like right now, it's Pages, Keynote, and Numbers, iMovie, iPhoto, and GarageBand. I'm actually really excited about iPhoto coming into the school, because I think one of the things that is interesting about iPhoto is that it obsoletes about 15 different image manipulation apps that we used to use separately, you know, for taking the color out and different stuff. That used to be an app, and now it's just a feature in iPhoto. So the Apple iWork suite, the Apple iLife suite, Explain Everything, which we've talked about with Roshan before, PDF Expert, which I keep going on about because it is just so great, and it's also the app that we use for doing digital exam papers in our school. Obviously, the big three that we just mentioned, iTunes U, Shobi, Google Drive, and iBooks, goes in there too. iThoughts, the mind mapping tool. Procreate, which is a drawing tool, a kind of painting drawing application. An app called Moodboard, which some people might know, some people might not know, but it's basically a kind of digital collage application that we use a lot for as a starting point for creative writing, for example. We like an app called Animation Creator, where you can basically animate anything you want in that app. And finally, Book Creator, which is an app that many, many people love, which basically lets you make fixed position EPUB files right on the iPad. So it's kind of, it's the iBooks author of the iPad, if you like. It's not, doesn't make iBooks author files, but it's to me the best and most full-featured ebook creator on the iPad. And the beauty of it, like we said before, Bradley, was that this is a pure iOS workflow where I can start my project in iOS, I can build the book, and then I can read it in iBooks all on the iPad, as opposed to an iBooks author thing where I've got to do this bit on the Mac and this bit on the iPad and blah, 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 blah. So those are some of the apps we'll talk about in the future. And as teachers kind of give us new ideas, we'll maybe mention some of those as well.
Yeah, that'll be a fun summer for us as well. So what are your thoughts on plain text? You know, we hear this a lot around the internet. You know, got to stick everything in plain text. You don't want to use these services that kind of suck in all your data and make it hard to get out. And even if you can, it's not in a usable format. You know, because you have this balance between planning for the future versus, you know, how do you get stuff done today and the best workflows today? Like, what are your thoughts there?
Good question. I used to kind of lean more towards this, but I think as I've kind of moved from communicating a lot with nerds in a programming world to communicating with normal people, if I email people, say, a markdown document, they may find that rather confusing. Whereas if I email them a PDF that I made from Pages, they can follow that, for example. So I think there's an element of audience there and who you're working with. But the question of lock-in is an interesting one, and it's particularly interesting for education because one of the things about what we do in school is that you can always change it, right? Because the school population is transient. You know, kids move through the school, they leave the school, and new people come in, and you know, it's, you only have to be doing something 3, 4, 5 years before a significant minority of your entire school are used to doing it that way, you know. So we have, you know, the first 3 year groups in our school, they've never been to school without iPad, for example. So I'm cautious about it, but I'm not religious about it. Let's say, I think there are some formats that you have a reasonable feeling are going to last for a reasonable time. Now, of course, that's what everybody said about Flash, right? So you've always got to be looking down the road, I would say, and see what's going away. But is Pages going away? Is Keynote going away? Not soon. I'm not saying never, but not soon. Obviously, Word documents live forever as well, much to some of our distaste. But I think more and more, when we end up kind of writing in systems to manage chunks of text rather than files. Does that even make sense as a thing to say?
No, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I'm thinking like Evernote, and also like, you know, you mentioned RunWeb and, you know, Salesforce, and, you know, we've used Basecamp in the past as well. We still use it, but not as much anymore because it doesn't work too well in the iPad. And those are things where, you know, I don't have files in there, but I have data in there. And I think the question is, how can you extract that? How can you pull it out? And that's a transition that we're sort of thinking about, is we're toying with the idea of moving from Basecamp into Evernote for Business as our kind of school knowledge management system, you know. And that would be a big job. There's no question about it. But it's a big job. But all the data in there is plain text, and it's files, right? It's PDF files and chunks of plain text. And the difficulty is not always so much the format conversion as the extraction from one system and put it into another. So it's not even just that it's plain text or that it's a native file format as much as it's in this data management system, and then it moves into this data management system, right? So one could argue that maybe a shared Dropbox might be the safest thing to do. But most people are not used to working in plain text. Nerds, of course, are, but most normal people are used to working in an app, and they make a file and they save it that way. And it'd be interesting to see, could you make that cultural change between people who are, you know, whether Word or Pages centric, and get them into something like Evernote? I know for us it's been very hard to get people out of the idea of, I make a document in Pages and then I upload it to Basecamp. And so I'm saying, you know, just write it in Basecamp. Just write it in Basecamp. Don't put it in a file and then put it in Basecamp. But, you know, I mean, the real world's full of people who they write an email in Word and then they attach the Word file to an email and then they send the email, right? It's hard. What do you think? I mean, are you a religious guy on plain text?
Oh, no. I guess I maybe more used to be, and then I really started to love Evernote, and now I just throw everything into Evernote. I mean, I think a good example is I'm sitting here looking at our show notes, and it's got, you know, bullet list and, you know, indentions done from there, and it looks really nice. It was really easy to use. And could we accomplish... So I guess let me, for our listeners, I'll explain how we use Evernote for the show. So we have 6 shared notebooks. We have expenses, feedback form, old feedback, revenue, show notes, and sponsorship inquiries. So the expenses is basically like if we, you know, when we have to pay for the hosting and things like that, those get sent into Evernote. Feedback form is people that have actually requested, you know, send us information. Old feedback is where we archive feedback that we haven't, you know, talked about on the show, or we have talked about on the show, but we still want to keep it just for future reference. Revenue is invoices that are paid from sponsors. Show notes is obviously just the show notes, and we use each show has its own note. And then sponsorship inquiries is just for when we communicate with sponsors, we can document it so, you know, Fraser and I can both see it. Could all that be done with Dropbox and folders and text documents and PDFs? Absolutely. There's no reason it couldn't be. But what's the benefit there? Like, you know, could we write markdown files in text editor for the show notes? Sure, I guess. And we could just open up Marked or Byword and display those. I guess that works fine. But Evernote's also pretty simple. And it's really, really easy. And I can edit it from my iPad. A lot of times I'll... you know, brainstorm on show notes before I go to bed at night. My wife maybe has already gone to sleep. I'll stay up and just make notes, and a lot of times they're just to myself. You know, I guess that works on the iPad or the iPhone. I have to get a text document or a text editor and point it to that folder. And again, that all works fine. It's just Evernote's so easy. And then I also consider, like, thinking back, you know, I've been out of school a good, you know, 11, 12 years now, high school anyways. I don't have anything from high school I still have. I have none of those papers. I do not have those. I do not even need those. I don't even know what I would do if I had them all. And so, like, you have to ask yourself the question, like, what's the value of what you're doing versus, like, what is a service like Salesforce or Basecamp or Evernote give you? And I think you'll see oftentimes the value that those, you know, programs give you very much outweighs the drawbacks. And most of them have export features. You know, a good one would anyways. Even Google offers that. So,
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the older you get, the more you're able to distinguish between the work that is really going to be valuable in the long term and stuff that's just throw away for today. I mean, so much of the stuff that goes through my Evernote account is stuff that I want to keep for a week or a month, and then I delete it again. Now, a lot of stuff stays there forever as well, but you know, it's things like, here's my boarding pass for a flight. Just, you know, fire that into Evernote because I can print it to a PDF and it's easy. And then I delete it again once that flight is over. But then there's other things where, you know, you are investing a lot of time and effort into it, and you do need to be careful about it. And a good example of this is the content that goes into my iTunes U courses, for example. Now, that's text that I want to keep for the long haul because I'm going to use it again and again and again. And I don't want that locked up in iTunes U either. You know, I don't want to just... sometimes I do if I'm in a rush, but and then I copy it back out again. But I rarely write my posts directly into iTunes U. I'll write them somewhere else first in a text document or something, and then I'll store that and copy and paste it into iTunes U. So sometimes you have to evaluate what it is you're doing. Is this for the long term, or is it just something throwaway? And convenience trumps long-term maintainability if it's just something short-term as well. I think it's also a young man's thing, a young nerd's thing in particular, to kind of imagine, you know, it's really good fun to kind of squirrel away and imagine a infinitely scalable, long-term, generationally backed up text file system, right? And every young nerd goes into that, but I guess the kind of older you get, the more you realize you wasted a lot of time building that you could have spent doing something much more practical that would actually have had more impact. Because people change their tastes more often than they change, than the world falls apart and gets put back together with different systems going away and coming in again.
Well, and if Dropbox went away, all the people that are the plain text people, how would they sync anything?
Yeah, I guess we're kind of living through that with Google Reader right now, aren't we? You know, it's if Google Reader goes away, you know, surely that can't go away. Well, yes, it can go away. I mean, I guess the beauty of something like Dropbox is that at least, you know, say, for example, Dropbox shut down catastrophically one day, you would at least still have your locally synced copy on your disk that you could then move somewhere else. And that's true of, you know, most things. The thing I like about Evernote is that you can do your exports from the app itself. So even if the Evernote data center somehow is destroyed or whatever, I could still export all my notes from the app that I have right now here today and get it into something else. Because I think a lot of the problems that people run into with these systems is not so much... the system I'm using today just fell apart and I can't get all the stuff that I was working on yesterday out. It's much more often, there's this thing I did 10 years ago and I've ignored it for 10 years and now I want to look at it again. Oh, well, I can't get a WordStar file opened off of a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk. What am I to do? You know, so it's much more things like that, I think, rather than your live working system today just falls apart tomorrow. It's a thing I did 10 years ago. How do I get access to that today? And that is a tricky thing. If you don't pay attention to these systems, what are you going to do?
Really, for me, the thing on my computer that I most want in its native file format are my photos. You know, that's family photos. You can't replace those. So those things are... I don't even keep those in iPhoto anymore. They're in folders organized by month, and they're... Most of them are actually on Dropbox, and the rest of them are backed up to multiple Time Machine drives along with CrashPlan. So I am very concerned about my photos. But, I mean, a good example, I have a folder called Manuals, or a notebook called Manuals in Evernote. That's, like, full of, like, appliance manuals and, like, my lawnmower manual. You know, and if that was gone, like if, you know, if Evernote died, it's still in a PDF and I could still export it. And I guess I am getting a little older and, you know, I look at that and most of the stuff I had in there, I could recreate if I had to. And again, it's still in there and they've got an export feature. So I don't know. This may have been a little bit of a rat hole, but the more I use Evernote, the more I get more and more of my stuff in there, more and more of my life, really, the more I kind of love it. And it's really nice and it's really easy.
I agree. And it's funny you should mention photos because I'm just looking at my photos hard drive sitting in the corner of my desk here and thinking all of this stuff applies to Aperture as well. And it applies to the raw file formats, you know, because I've got something like 30,000 Canon RAW files on that disk. And I'm thinking, well, A, what happens when Canon RAW files become unreadable in the future, you know, whenever? B, what happens when Aperture eventually goes away, if it ever goes away? Because there's a lot of information in my Aperture database that doesn't exist on disk except in that database file. For example, the way Aperture works, it takes a RAW file, then it stores modifications to that file in a database. And then if you want a JPEG of that, it will render those modifications on top of that RAW file and then export that JPEG out. So that's a RAW file processing workflow that is highly proprietary, closed source, and I have to have some confidence that Aperture is going to keep being developed. And that's something that some people are a bit nervous about. And there's very often conversations amongst my photography-loving friends on Twitter about how I want to switch to Lightroom from Adobe. How do I take my Aperture library and move it over to Lightroom? And the answer is you absolutely can't. The best you can do would be to export all the adjustments you've made, just call that a day, save that in a file and start fresh in Lightroom, for example. So there are certainly some of these workflows that are tricky, and you've got to pay attention to them. Certainly ones you've invested a lot of time and effort in, like my Aperture database, you got to think about. You got to keep your eyes open and see, was that still a live system or not? And that's a question that you got to answer.
That's true. Well, how many more weeks of school do you guys have?
Oh, too many.
We have four.
Our study leave starts next week, so half of my classes are off for the whole week studying for exams. We had the last computer science, or computing studies rather, standard grade exam. That was last Friday. So that course is now done. It will never be taught again. It's been replaced with a new course next year. So I think we've got 3 weeks of exams. Then we've got a week of holiday, and then I'm back a week from that holiday. Then we go to Rwanda with the iPad project out to Rwanda for 2 weeks. Then I'm back for a week, and that's the summer holidays. And then I start to really tear things apart in the school. So I'm looking forward to that.
Maybe we should just set up like a live Skype cam to watch you do stuff. Unbox.
Yeah, just unbox iPads in a Google Hangout forever. That could be my life.
This would. I know for me, I always borrow a scanner from our church to scan the barcodes of the iPads. Because when you buy them in bulk here in the States, I don't know if it's that way with you guys, but they actually, even the bulk barcode boxes, even the bulk boxes have the barcodes on the outside to grab the serial number. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of understanding like you, I wish I could get the MAC address from that easily. It would be nice.
You can export that information out of Apple Configurator. I just learned. Once you've supervised the devices in Apple Configurator, you can select them and then you can export device info. And it basically gives you five things you can choose: the device name, device model, storage capacity, serial number, Wi-Fi MAC address, and Bluetooth MAC address, and it can just spit out a CSV of all of that. So I'm wondering if once we image them all through Configurator, I could just, because the devices are recorded in Configurator even after they're disconnected, so you can still look at the ones you've previously configured, whether we could just do it that way instead of having to barcode them all as we go. We could just say, or just open all the boxes and plug in all the iPads, and then once we've done that, export a CSV from Configurator.
Well, because that MAC address can be very helpful with, if you're dealing with, you know, connectivity issues. If a student says, "Hey, I'm having problems," I don't know if you've run into this, but in Aerohive's Hive Manager, there's a tool called the Client Monitor where you can basically put in a MAC address, and it watches everything that that device does from a networking standpoint. And so, like, if you are having issues, it allows you to kind of, you know, further delve into what's going on. I had a teacher laptop that would every morning would have problems getting online. Of course, your immediate thing is, well, it's got to be the internet. It's got to be the wireless. Well, it turns out when I was watching it, it was never asking for a DHCP lease. So, like, it wasn't doing anything but just, like, basically searching for the network it had already connected to. So I went in there, and blew away the keychain information of the airport, and it's been fine since. So that's just one of the ways we're having that MAC address. You know, you don't have to go get the student's iPad and, you know, write it down and take a picture of it and then input it. You can just have it right there in a CSV file, and you're good to go.
Yeah, this is the thing. I when I was doing this today, I was thinking about it too many different ways. There's lots of different ways you can track a device, but trying to figure out what's the best thing to do, because there's also options like one of the things we do at the moment, because all our iPads are on the same SSID using the same key, then in the AeroHive dashboard, I can't see by the AeroHive username, but I can see by the device name, because all our devices are named for the person that they were issued to. So the actual iPad device name is, you know, April Spears or whatever. I can see, well, device April Spears, which belongs to the everyone user, is doing this thing. So I'm trying to think how we do that in Configurator, and what's the moving parts of that? You know, which part is unique to the user and which part is generic, and where does MDM fit into all this stuff? That's a show for the future. I haven't figured all that out yet, but so I don't want to nail my colors to the mast on that. But this is where we get the big bucks, I think.
Yeah, I agree. It's why
you get it right in the summer, and your life is a joy.
So, well, good show, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up there. I will go back to Apple Configurator. Keep working on that. We should talk MDM at some point as well. But let's leave it there for now. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bradley, where can people find you on Twitter
and the rest? At Bradley Chambers on Twitter and Chambers Daily on the web.
Which was just linked to by John Gruber. Congratulations on that. And congratulations for surviving the traffic onslaught as well.
Thank you. All appreciation goes to Squarespace.
And we are the only podcast in the world that they don't sponsor, so what's going on with that?
You know, it's funny that someone made the joke on Twitter that they said, does it bother anyone that Squarespace is basically funding the entire podcasting network of the internet? Hey, but it works. I mean, I have probably eight sites, because we had used them in the past for our site, and it was just some issues with their way the podcasting setup worked. But, like, I have a lot of websites through them, like personal website there. Mm-hmm. I just actually had my first experience with Squarespace Commerce, and it's really, really nice. You can sell stuff digitally on there. They do a good job, and their sites don't go down. So that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my blog has been on Squarespace for a number of years. I haven't transitioned yet to Squarespace 6, but that's... That's probably a job for a year this summer. I'm not doing anything else this summer except iPads and a little bit of network configuration. That's my summer. Anyway, I'm Fraser Spears, Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web, and catch us next time.
Have a good week.